You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Stephen Rowley.
Thanks for tuning in to Author Stories. We've got a great show lined up for you today. Before we get started, I'd like to thank some sponsors for making the show possible. Patricia Gillum, World Gone Red, her new short story, Heroes of Corvus, Book 2, a sequel to A Superhero's Duty. Daniel Spires reveals to his team and Icarus that someone has been mass abducting the children of modern heroes and villains around the world. Icarus searches for answers while dealing with the physical aftermath of his encounter with Hellstorm. His powers are fading, and a compromised hero may cost him his life. This is an excellent new series from Patricia Gillum. There's going to be more coming soon. Stay tuned for it. Get in on the series while it's unfolding. Patricia Gillum, World Gone Red, Heroes of Corvus, Book 2. I'd also like to thank Richard Fox and his Ember War Saga. Guys, if you love science fiction the way I do, you must read the Ember War Saga. 9 books with several spinoffs, lots of great stuff going on in the Ember War. This one, and if you love audio, let me tell you, Luke Daniels narrates the audio for this series, and it is absolutely amazing. We're going to be talking about the Ember War Saga more in coming episodes, but go check it out on Amazon, The Ember War Saga by Richard Fox. Now on to our great show. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm excited to have Stephen Rowley on the show with me today. He has a fantastic new book called The Editor that I think you guys are really going to love. Welcome to the show, Stephen.
Thank you for having me.
I'm excited to have you. We begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Oh, goodness. I can think back all the way. And in fact, writers always steal little autobiographical nuggets to insert into their work. Sure. But, you know, and there is a similar story in The Editor, my new novel coming out April 2nd. But I remember that my mother had a robin's egg blue typewriter, probably from the 1960s. And she had it in the house. I'm not even sure why. But I sort of coveted that typewriter as, I was one of 4 kids, but that I had my eye on that. That sort of belonged to me. But there was something about typing very simple stories, and it would take me hours to, type a paragraph probably. But there was something about typing out a story that made me feel sort of published in a way that lended some authenticity to it. And I just remember the joy in sort of seeing my words typed up like that. I would get upset when the ribbon would get tangled or whatever, and she had 3 other kids to deal with, and she wouldn't prioritize the typewriter ribbon repair as quite as high on her list as I wanted her to. But that's some of my earliest memories of writing.
That's fantastic. You know, there's still something very visceral and magical about the typewriter. And no matter how technology moves forward and I wouldn't trade my laptop for a typewriter for my daily writing. But there's something, I don't know, there's this romantic connection with it.
The sounds that it makes too. I mean, the sort of bell and the carriage return, and it's such, there's just nothing quite as tactile as an old typewriter.
Well, as a kid in the 80s when I took typing class, when we still had mm-hmm. such a thing in high school as typing class, mm-hmm. We had IBM Selectrics, I think the Model 2. And there was something about putting your hands, your fingers on the home row keys and feeling the vibration in there. To this day, that's such a visceral memory. And it's just this feeling of possibility. And it's just so funny to me how we get connected to tools like that.
Yeah, I think we were probably the last ones to squeak through in the 80s with typing classes on typewriters. But I did this the same. And looking back, it's so funny. It's, you know, I took typing on a whim, not knowing that it was probably the most important class I took in school, based on what I do today.
Right. It's so funny. So funny. So the experience with the typewriter and getting these stories out, was there ever, an adult in your life, maybe your mom, who fixed the typewriter for you, maybe a school teacher, anyone who recognized that you had this storytelling gift or gene and gave you any encouragement?
Yeah, there were a number of teachers, that had a profound effect on my life. And not all of them English teachers either.
Sure.
Yeah, and early on, I was very involved in drama and acting too, and that was a way to sort of be a vessel for other people's stories. But I always loved stories and storytelling, even if I wasn't the one doing the writing. But yeah, there were a number of people who had a sort of profound effect on my life.
At what point, Stephen, did you realize that this was something that you wanted to pursue career-wise?
That's an interesting question. It was a sort of strange evolution. I studied film in college. I moved to Los Angeles after college thinking I would pursue a career in film production. And that sort of soon led to writing. I was, attempting to make a go of it as a screenwriter for years here before turning to novel writing. And that has its ups and downs. I enjoy the sort of collaborative nature of writing for film, but it's also sometimes a case of writers' voices aren't the ones who rise to the top, which is why I think we see a lot of mediocre films, to be quite frank. You know, the screenwriter is not always very high on the totem pole. You know, I sort of accidentally fell into novel writing, but I remember the first time I sat down with my editor for my first book, and she gave me some notes and said something like, "But I defer to your vision as the creative authority." And I almost fell out of my chair because in 15 years of trying to make a go of it as a screenwriter, I'd never heard anyone defer to my authority.
Well, it's so weird. We think of films, we think of a director, a strong director,
yeah.
And you say, "Oh, well, that's a Spielberg film. I'm definitely mm-hmm. going to see that." Mm-hmm. Or we think of a strong, acting presence from an actress or an actor, and they it's like we focus more on those the director or the actor's interpretation of the writing as our experience, and they're interpreting what one of us has written. And I think it's a tragedy that the focus has shifted the way it has.
Yeah. You can name a handful of screenwriters maybe that have broken through that, like Charlie Kaufman or a William Goldman or something, where you sort of know the writer a little bit if you're a true cinephile, but that's the exception, not the rule.
Right. At what point did you shift to writing fiction, and what was the catalyst to move from screenwriting to prose?
Yeah, when I wrote my first novel, Lily and the Octopus, was something I sat down to write. I chose to write it as a novel because it was a deeply personal story to me. It was very autobiographical. And I just couldn't, there were things that I wanted to do with the story that one, I couldn't imagine doing on film. And two, because it was so personal to me, I didn't want all these other voices chiming in. It was very personal and private to me. So once I decided to write it as a novel, I sort of gave myself the challenge of breaking every screenwriting rule I could think of. So, you know, when you write for film, it's very you have to show a lot through action or dialogue. It's very external. But when I wrote Lily and the Octopus, it's very sort of an internal story. A lot of it takes place inside the main character's imagination. There's a dog that he hears talk to him. One of the main characters is an octopus. So, you know, everything I could think of, producer would say, nope, can't do that. Not paying for that. That's not even possible. put it all in the book, and had quite a good time doing it. It was a, you know, I leaned into what novels could do. And I think, I had a lot of fun with that.
That's one of the great things about novel writing is there are no budgetary constraints. We can make explosions as big as we want. We can write fantastical creatures. We can write reality that reads like dream sequences. And there's our imaginations are the only limit.
Yeah. Yeah.
What was the initial idea for Lily and the Octopus? Where did that story come from?
Well, so Lily was a dog and that I had from puppyhood into old age, and she was a sort of constant companion to me. You know, writing can be a very solitary occupation, and I didn't realize how much I had come to lean on this dog and her presence in my life. She passed away in 2013 of a brain tumor.
I'm sorry.
This is, you know, I thought I was prepared intellectually anyway. We know dogs don't, or animals don't live as long as we do, certainly as long as we wish they would. But I was really sidelined by grief and not really sort of understanding why this loss had such an impact on me. And so I did what writers do, which is sort of sit down to write about the experience to try to understand it. I soon realized what I was writing about was attachment and how difficult it can be to let go. And in that sense, an octopus sort of entered the story because, there was something about having a tentacular sort of metaphor that made sense to me, something that could have a literal stranglehold on you. I never really thought that there was a octopus stuck to my dog. I was pretty clear what was happening to her in real life, but the story sort of went from there. And then once I realized there was an octopus, I thought, well, I need to write the book in 8 parts, and there's all this sort of imagery and symbolism and whatnot. And I really had a good time with it. And it was a very healing experience. However, if you want to hear crickets on the other end of a phone, try calling literary agents and say, do you have any interest in my book about a dog with an octopus stuck to her head? Because you don't get very far, certainly. And, over a year, I couldn't get anywhere with this book. And so I thought I might self-publish it. Self-publishing can be a wonderful road for writers now, but it does sort of run the gamut. There's all sorts of stuff out there, and I knew that I wanted to appear as professional as possible. So it was suggested to me that I hire an independent sort of freelance editor, which I did, to sort of polish the book. And she was able to get it in through a connection that she had to an editor at Simon & Schuster. And I still didn't think much would come from that because I had received so many rejections for the book. But sure enough, they really took a shine to the book and said, you know, we'd like to make an offer. You need to get an agent. And, you know, for any aspiring writers out there, I can tell you, if you have an offer for publication, it's much easier to get an agent.
Yes.
In fact, you can kind of choose. So that was a really sort of magical experience, you know, and I've been around the block long enough to know that that's not really how it works. So, I'm not one to really believe that, you know, there was a little dog up there pulling the strings, but you know, it's hard not to think there was a little bit of magic around this.
Right. Well, one thing is really interesting about, writing as processing grief. I think some of the best writing I've ever done is when I was working through things like that, maybe with one of my kids or something. And there's what's unique or unexpected. I think people expect that if you're writing out of grief or you're processing these emotions and these feelings, that everything is going to be morbid and it's going to look like someone is processing grief. A lot of times what comes out can oftentimes be funny, can be warm, and can be quirky, and the grief in that is worked into that somehow. But the end product can be something very different than what is expected. At the end of that project, how did you feel about what you had created, and do you feel like that it became kind of more than the sum of its parts?
Yeah, it really did. When I finished it, I was proud of it as a piece of writing. But, you know, the voices that are inside of our head as artists that devalue our own work are loud and they are persistent. So even though I thought this is a good piece of writing, I didn't think that it would have anything to offer anyone who did not know me or did not know this dog. And so, you know, I instantly thought, you know, who cares? And what the real surprise of this journey has been is that how much it has touched other people and how sort of universal processing grief or the desire to understand grief has been. Now, this book went on to be translated in 19 languages, and it was a bestseller. And now, even though I broke every screenwriting rule, Amazon Studios has picked it up for a film adaptation. So working on that. So it's been so rewarding to see other people respond to something that I thought was maybe individual to me.
Right. And what a fantastic story, that not only the book, but the story around the book, it has to make you very proud that this relationship, begat all of these wonderful things.
Yeah, it really is a gift that she has, that dog, had given me, and it's, wonderful to think about all the new friends that she's making through, readers across the world.
Right.
You know, she was a dachshund. So for a girl with ridiculously, comically short legs, she's really traveled around the world.
Oh, that's fantastic. Let's talk about the new book, The Editor. So coming from a book like that, we talk about this a lot, is one of the great gifts for a writer a lot of times is the anonymity of the first book. No one knows you're writing it. No one's expecting anything. Mm-hmm. It's a solitary life, but it's your life and no one's expecting anything. Well, then that first book happens and you find, a tremendous amount of success with that, like you did. And then you follow that up. Where does The Editor come into your life?
Yeah, it's an interesting follow up because there's no dog this time, and everybody wanted to know. You know, sort of the elevator pitch for The Editor is a young writer in early 1990s New York City, armed with a candidly autobiographical manuscript that he wrote, finds out a publisher is interested in it, and the editor. Who is interested, turns out to be Jacqueline Onassis, who did indeed work as an editor, first at Viking Press and then at Doubleday for 15 years after, her divorce from Aristotle Onassis. So, that's quite a leap from what the first book was, on its surface. However, it made sense to me. And what I thought, about in choosing a subject for a next book was, I sat down when I wrote Lily and the Octopus to write to try to understand. And I wanted to sort of be armed with that mission again. Now, I wrote an autobiographical novel in Lily, and it exploded in a way that was much bigger than I ever imagined. So I wrote some deeply personal things, about myself, about other people. But even though I change the names, some identities are hard to mask. You know, mom comes to mind, for instance. You know, it, somehow Eagle Eye readers crack that code. you know, I thought about a character, you know, with a similar situation who writes something very honest about his family and the people in his life, and what would be a way that it might explode into a much bigger way that he intends. Well, if Jacqueline Onassis got her hands on him, you know, and what if that family were Irish Catholic and they grew up sort of revering the Kennedys, and now he's written about sort of his own mother's flaws, and they're in the hands of someone who we viewed sort of as America's mother, or the idealized, you know, image of motherhood. So he's sort of trapped between these two strong women in his life. And from there I was off to the races.
What a fantastic meta story, if you will. The first book that you wrote is so much about you, and then you write a book about a man writing a book that is so much about him. Did you ever kind of sit back and kind of chuckle at just kind of the glorious absurdity of it all?
I certainly had fun with it. There were sort of moments where, you know, I tried to think back at some of the oddities that happened with Lily, and tried to make them entertaining. You know, it's interesting because you know, in writing about grief and the dog, you know, the octopus entered the picture. And that's what really sort of turned it into a novel. And similarly with the editor, you know, the process of what happened to me, it was not enough to make a great novel. I needed to find, and pardon me, with all due respect to Mrs. Onassis, you know, I needed to find my octopus for this new book. And that's where she came in. It sort of needed that sort of extra element of magic. And so yeah, there was all these sort of meta moments that made it very rewarding as a project.
I love the idea of Jackie O as the octopus without having to go all you know, Cthulhu on it or anything.
Yeah, no, right. I'm sure I'm the only person who's ever used her name and the word octopus in the same sentence.
Of course, but we all understand and we get it now. She was such a larger than life dynamic character, and I think for people of yours and my generation, our recollections of her are as Mrs. Onassis and mm-hmm. her later career. For my parents' generation, she would be, Jackie Kennedy.
Mrs. Of course. Kennedy.
Yeah. Mrs. Kennedy, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And the first lady. And, so we all have these very, particular memories of her and ideas of her. When you start, for lack of a better word, humanizing her, or personalizing her, maybe is a better word. Really getting to her as an everyday person instead of this grand figure. Is that a daunting task when you're taking on, a real life character that we all have, ideas about?
Oh, hugely daunting. You know, everyone is going to have an opinion of who she was or what she sounded like. The wiggle room that I had, you know, so much that I had some, was that she was so private in this sort of third act in her life. I think in her entire 15-year career, she granted one interview. And other than that, she stayed out of the press for, you know, for her career. So not a lot of people know about what she was like as a colleague, a coworker, an editor, or what it was like to work with her in this fashion. So there are a couple wonderful biographies on her career, and certainly on her life, that mention her career. So yeah, I did all the research I could. I even read some of the books that she was working on at this time in her career, when the novel opens in 1992, so that I could see what were some of the subjects in her head, what were some of her interests right at that very moment, and what might have been occupying her mind, so that I could try to create this character. And then you do the best you can through all the research and everything. My editor, my publisher, Putnam, was very supportive in that they helped me track down some people who worked with her that would share their memories of working together. And then, you know, a little bit of is just sort of writerly creativity. You know, there's a little bit of my imagination in there. The book is sort of a wish fulfillment. I mean, how many of us wish we could sit down and had this kind of friendship with her? So, you know, there's a little bit of fun as well.
And it definitely comes out in the book. This is a this is a fun read, and like you said, a wish fulfillment this is something that will appeal to a wide audience. But there's something special for writers, I think, that they'll get from this book. The wish fulfillment aspect and the kind of insider and getting to be friends with the biggest insider, kind of thing. That's, that had to be a lot of fun to write.
Oh, it was enormous fun, to write. Not only in creating, a version of Mrs. Onassis. And I think, you know, her legacy truly endures, and there was something right now, you know, given our current climate, you know, whatever your beliefs are, there was a real class and gentility to her that I think, you know, all of us can miss and do miss. And so that was rewarding to write. It was also a very interesting time in publishing, you know, sort of the early to mid 90s when this book takes place, and that, you know, the sort of ebooks were coming down the pipeline. I think people saw this technology. There was a lot of nervousness in publishing about whether the printed book would endure or what it would look like, how things would change. And so it was an interesting time to just write about publishing in general.
Right. You talked about when you wrote Lily that you tried to break all of the screenwriting rules, and it became very introspective. And the editor is from a first person perspective, which, not many screenplays are. Mm-hmm. We normally have this, either an omniscient narrator or we have a very close, narrator, but we're separated. After having talked about that, I find two interesting things about this book. One, it does appear that you followed in a similar path with this book, and it is very introspective. But the dialogue is fantastic in this. Does writing dialogue well come from your years of screenplay writing? Because screenplays are almost all dialogue and a little instruction, but does writing screenplays help to hone that skill?
Absolutely. And I just personally, it's my favorite thing to write. I love writing dialogue. I love putting words in characters' mouths. It's just a lot of fun to me. And it's amazing how many people, particularly in screenwriting, struggle with dialogue sometimes. It's like, I guess, you know, so certain writers just have an ear for it, and certain others struggle with it. But it's something I've always enjoyed, and I don't know, you know, like it's hard for me to understand writers who struggle with it, because I think, you know, as writers, we're always listening, you know, listening to other people talk, and from that should come the ability to hopefully write good dialogue.
The book, The Editor, is out everywhere now. When people are hearing this, I can't say enough good things about this book. It is so much fun. It's such a great read. Stephen, if people are just learning about you and want to find out more about the work that you do and all of that, is there a place where they can connect with you online?
Yeah, I'm all over social media at Mr. Stephen Rowley. And you can find me at my website, StephenRowley.com.
Excellent. Stephen, we're going to send everybody to pick up their copy of The Editor. It's been so much fun talking with you. We wish you much success on the book. And we'll send everybody to see you.
Thank you so much. It's always fun to talk about the craft, and I appreciate your insightful questions.
Thanks for listening to the Author Stories Podcast. For more great author interviews like this one, go to hankgarner.com and dig through the archives. There's something there I know you'll love. Now stay tuned for a special audio clip from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane Series.
Hello, young one. What ghoulish tale of horror shall we explore tonight? Shall we watch The Creepshow? The Nightmare on Elm Street? Child of the Night, give me your answer.
Which one would Mom kill us for watching? Said Buddy. Dad grinned and his eyes grew wide.
Which do you think, Child of the Jackal?
The Omen!
And we might have time for Omen too, if we hurry. She'll be home by 11.
I'll be back. Buddy ran to his room. He stripped down to his Yoda underwear and fished in the closet. 2 minutes later, he snuck back into the living room wearing his skeleton costume from last Halloween. He crept up behind his dad, who was cueing the movie. But David Rittermeier was too clever for that. He spun around at the last moment and bared fang teeth torn from paper plates, drawing a yip of surprise and a cry of, "No fair!" Daddy kicked off his Reeboks, plopped his smelly gym socks on the coffee table, another thing that Mom would hate, and killed the lights. The scary intro music began. The screen showed the silhouette of a boy, about Buddy's age. His shadow was a long, creepy cross. The Antichrist, the son of the devil. Born of a jackal on a night of astrological portent, destined to bring about the end times and the final battle of good versus evil. Buddy sipped sun-kissed and scooted up next to his dad. As the movie got scarier, he slipped an arm through his father's and cupped his big bicep. Buddy could feel his father's pulse. Dads get scared, too. They flinched together, shouted together, pointed at the screen and covered their faces together. Buddy pressed his eyes to Daddy's shoulder just before the on-screen maid shouted, "It's all for you, Damien!" and dove from the roof, hanging herself. Buddy knew which parts he was old enough to watch and which parts he wasn't. He trusted his dad to let him know when to look again. Occasionally, his dad tricked him into peeking too soon, but that was part of the fun. They kicked their feet at the screen and shouted, "Look up! Look up! Oh, idiot! Don't get yourself killed!" At the climax, the hero of the movie, Mr. Thorne, discovered a birthmark of 3 sixes on his son's head and dragged the little Antichrist to the altar of the church, determined to spear his son with holy daggers and end evil forever. After it was over, the Rittermeier men sat silently through the credits. David put an arm around his son and ran his fingers through Buddy's hair. He wasn't searching for devil marks. He knew there weren't any. And Buddy was certain there were no daggers in his father's hand, either. Those things were just make-believe. Real fathers and sons don't do bad things to each other. They were queuing up Omen 2 when the power went out. "No," Buddy whined. "Not on movie night." Daddy went to the window. "It's the whole block. Sorry, Damien. How about, scary blackout? Go get the Ouija board out of the guest room closet.
Cool.
And candles." Buddy found the Ouija board, hidden under old clothes. When he shut the sliding door again, the sight of a monster startled him, and he let out an involuntary, "Huh!" sound. It was his own skeleton-bodied reflection in the mirrored closet door. He stared at it. He liked the effect of moonlight on his cheeks. Spectral, haunted, his eyes big and white. He clacked his teeth at himself, picturing his own grinning skull under his child's flesh, and gave an evil laugh. He was answered by a scream. A woman's scream. High-pitched and far away. One of the neighbors? Buddy dropped the Ouija board into a patch of moonlight and sat with it.
"What's going on?"
he whispered, his fingers on the heart-shaped wood planchette.